Live from Chicago, I'm John Dempsey for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by conservative Marty Garrity, Art Sear of Carthage College, and Robert Pape of the University of Chicago. Our program tonight coming to you from the XM Sirius studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our topic tonight for the entire 2 hours of our program is going to be Afghanistan. This past week, President Barack Obama spoke at the West Point Military Academy and outlined his plan for an additional 30,000 troops to be sent to that country over the next 6 months, with the goal being to start withdrawing those troops 1 year after that in the summer of 2011. I want to read to you a portion of an extensive piece in today's New York Times, How Obama Came to Plan for a Surge in Afghanistan. The piece talks about how Obama visited Arlington National Cemetery this past Veterans Day, and as he wandered among the chalky white tombstones of those who had fallen in the rugged mountains of Central Asia, his advisors say he was haunted by the human toll as he wrestled with what to do about the 8-year-old war. Just a month earlier, he had mentioned to his advisors his visits to wounded soldiers at the Army Hospital in Washington. "I don't want to be going to Walter Reed for another 8 years," he said then. The piece goes on to talk about the day Obama held his eighth meeting of his Afghanistan review and told his advisors he wanted the surge to start sooner and end sooner than suggested. It says, quote, "When the history of the Obama presidency is written, that day may prove to be a turning point, the moment a young commander-in-chief set in motion a high-stakes gamble to turn around a losing war. Mr. Obama is betting that a quick jolt of extra forces could knock the enemy back on its heels enough for the Afghans to take over the fight." Professor Pape, is he correct?
I don't think so. I'm afraid I think that this is a tragic mistake. I think it's a tragic mistake in several ways, but probably the most important way is that it's not really new. You see, since 2006, each year we've put in 20,000 or more U.S. and allied troops. Each year we have sized that increment to meet the current threat of the Taliban. And each year the threat has actually grown. I don't see any real reason to believe that this jolt is going to be any different than the last three that we've seen since 2006.
Art Sear.
I have a piece that was sent out on the Scripps Howard Wire at the end of the week entitled "The Ghost of Nixon Past." In many ways, it's almost eerily reminiscent of the strategy that President Nixon instituted in Vietnam. Simultaneously by, in this case, starting troop withdrawals, which is the going to be the end point of the surge. If it works as planned, Nixon was able to diffuse anti-war sentiment in this country, effectively pressure the South Vietnamese government to get more serious about fighting their own war and running their own country, and also was able to buy time and relieve considerable manpower pressures on the U.S. military. Those pressures are different today with the professional military, but they're certainly there. And in many ways, Obama's approach seems to me to be very similar to what Nixon did. I certainly, as an American, I certainly hope it works. And, it's what the military professionals want, given Bob's downbeat assessment, and I think that's important to keep in mind.
One of the points of your piece on the Scripps Howard News Service is that after 1969, the anti-war movement, it kind of lessened in intensity in this country.
Dramatically. Of course, we had a conscript army then. That's a very good point. I think more germane to our concerns is one of Lyndon Johnson's principal dilemmas. He's not a very attractive person, but he is a tragic leader in many ways. The public in this country strongly supported the Vietnam War, despite the demonstrations, up until the Tet Offensive in early 68, at which point support dropped. In the case of Afghanistan, initially, there was public support, but we've never had the kind of large-scale support for Afghanistan or substantial majority support at all for Iraq that the U.S. has to have to succeed in war.
Marty Garrity, what's your reaction to the announcement of the surge?
Well, it One of the more interesting things that happened today on one of the shows was General Petraeus was asked by Chris Wallace, when you were discussing this with the president, did he agree that the Iraqi surge had worked? Did he say this Iraqi surge had worked? And Petraeus said, yes. And shortly thereafter, Petraeus seemed to think, oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that. And so he sort of tried to backtrack. But essentially, the Iraqi surge did work. Now, you can't.
And Petraeus said that the president admitted to him in private.
That in private, Barack Obama had said to him that the surge in Iraq had worked, and essentially, let's make it work in Afghanistan. The surge in Iraq generally worked primarily, I think, because they sent the troops out into the villages. They did not limit them to the cities, and they went out, as McChrystal has said, to protect the people. It's hard to say that they're going to be able to send enough troops out into the Afghan villages, but if they can protect the cities, the surge has a chance. The problem is, what else could we do? Unless you are prepared for any country, whether it be Sudan or Ethiopia or Afghanistan, unless you're prepared for that country to be a place where Al-Qaeda can regroup and attack us again, as they did when they were free to roam Afghanistan in the late 90s and in the beginning of this decade. What could you do? You have to go after them. You have to try to stop them. Especially, I think, a Democratic president has to do that, because Democrats, rightly or wrongly, are identified as less willing to exert U.S. power.
And from a political standpoint, Marty, we all know that President Obama ran on the platform of Afghanistan being the good war.
Again, what could he do? If he said all through his campaign, we got to fight that war, we've been fighting the wrong war and winning. He wouldn't admit that we were winning the wrong war. But if he's been saying all along that we must fight the Afghan war, how can he then turn around and say, let's stop doing this and let's let the bad guys take over there? Because there really can be no argument. If we were to stop fighting the Afghan war, the bad guys would be back in. And then now they have an airport that they can land in freely and places where they can hide weapons and do things that ultimately threaten the U.S. And fundamentally, the only thing that interests me is the safety of the United States, the safety of the people in the United States. And if they're going to use Afghanistan as a place to, as a base for finding ways to kill Americans, they must be stopped regardless of cost and really regardless of whether the American people are tuned into that.
But what if Al-Qaeda is now forming in Yemen? Do we send troops to Yemen? I mean, they're branching out all over the
place. That's a very important point.
It's a key point.
Al-Qaeda is, I'm not gainsaying expanding efforts and focusing much more on Afghanistan, which I think is the right thing to do, but Al-Qaeda has been virulently active in Somalia, Yemen, other parts of Africa. There's a tremendous amount of recruiting going on there and in the former Soviet Union.
1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. This is Beyond the Beltway coming to you from Chicago. Stay where you are. We will be back.
This year, Napa has great holiday deals on gifts any handyman will truly appreciate. Choose from a durable 9-piece combination wrench set or a 42-piece SAE and metric socket set for just $9.55 each. The 42-piece socket set includes quarter-inch and 3/8-inch drives to help tackle any job. Stop by your local Napa Auto Parts store today and check out these great holiday deals. Napa. Get the
good! Hey, that stack of money over there with the googly eyes, is that the money you could be saving with Geico?
It's the money I am saving with Geico. He helped me buy this pool table.
Nice. So what else does he do? Can he tell jokes?
Seriously, Kevin, he's a stack of money. He doesn't tell jokes. He just blinks and buys me stuff.
Well, I just thought...
Money can't talk. That's ridiculous. Why do you always take it too far?
Me?
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
From coast to coast, from border to border, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway live from Chicago this evening. I'm John Dempsey, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. And we are talking tonight about Afghanistan. And one of our guests is Robert Pape of the University of Chicago, who you and I interviewed you a couple of years ago, Bob, when you wrote Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. And I think one of the central tenets of that book is that we see terrorism where there are soldiers who are deemed as foreign invaders. And that is the in your research and your studies, that is what you have found is the reason for terrorism. Is that right?
That's right. What I did a few years ago is I created the first complete database of all suicide terrorist attacks around the world since 1980. You might think that some other government or some other think tank would have done that. The truth is, before I did that in 2003, it just hadn't been done. And then shortly thereafter, our Defense Department, a number of foundations came in to support this work. And that's what led to the first book, and now next September there'll be a second book coming out, which is also looking at the global patterns of suicide terrorist attacks around the world. And the key thing that jumps right out at you when you focus on suicide terrorism is that it's the lung cancer of terrorism. You see, suicide terrorism kills more people than all the other forms of terrorism combined, and it has a specific risk factor, much the way lung cancer does. And the specific risk factor of suicide terrorism is foreign occupation. If you look at suicide terrorist attacks around the world, they're very clumpy. 95% of all the suicide terrorist attacks around the world occur not in some scattered fashion in a thin way across the globe, but in really about 10 or 12 specific clumps. And those specific clumps are the West Bank. They are in Lebanon. They are now in Iraq, now in Afghanistan. And what they have in common is foreign military occupation. And what has occurred and what's occurred in Afghanistan is that before our invasion and conquest of Afghanistan in 2001, there were no suicide terrorist attacks in that country, even with Osama bin Laden living there for years. And in fact, even the first couple years after our toppling of the Taliban, there were no suicide or hardly any suicide attacks.
But 9/11 was plotted in Afghanistan.
Well, it was plotted.
And we didn't have any troops there when it was plotted.
Well, let's just be careful about what we mean by that. The energy for 9/11, 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. Two others came from the UAE, that is the Arabian Peninsula. What was really motivating the attackers on 9/11 was our military presence on the Arabian Peninsula, something that had really been in place throughout the entire 1990s. Yes, it's true that bin Laden was in Afghanistan. Yes, it's true he had camps. Yes, it's true that even Mohammed Atta went to Afghanistan to meet bin Laden. But the fact of the matter is that sanctuary was nowhere near as important to killing the 3,000 people who died on 9/11 than American flight schools. What really made 9/11 deadly was the willingness of 19 individuals to kill themselves, and they're going to American flight schools to learn the true skills they needed to kill those people.
And you've made the point that they did that because our troops were stationed in Saudi Arabia after the 1991 first
exactly.
Gulf War.
What happened is that in the 1970s and 80s, the United States did not station a single combat soldier on the Arabian Peninsula. And then we did in 1990, we stationed a large army there to reverse Saddam Hussein's conquest of Kuwait. And we successfully did that. And I think that was actually quite an importantly good thing to do. But then we made the tragic mistake in the 90s of keeping 30 to 40,000 combat soldiers on the Arabian Peninsula, not advisors with sidearms, but tanks, fighter aircraft, and armor vehicles. And our military, 30 or 40,000 of our high-tech precision military, is quite a powerful force. In fact, you saw that when in 2003, we just quickly toppled Saddam's government in just a few weeks. So the fact is, when we station 30 or 40,000 combat soldiers on in a region, especially in just a couple of countries, we really do have the ability to topple governments and maintain governments in power.
All right, Sarah, what do you think about Bob's theories that we see terrorism, we see suicide attacks when there are foreign troops in a Muslim country?
Well, Bob's theories are based on extensive and very specific quantitative research. So, and for that reason, because there's so much rhetoric connected with a situation, I'm very impressed, and I certainly commend his book, which I read with great interest and learned from. I'd put a question mainly to Bob, I guess. Is there not a series of complicating factors, including alienation of Osama bin Laden and other Mujahideen who fought with the Americans and the CIA initiated a very successful effort to assist the insurgency against the Soviets in the 1980s? And secondly, would you agree that we can't ignore the political calculus in the United States after 9/11, whatever the problem of having American forces stationed on Arab or Muslim soil, we had to overthrow the regime in Afghanistan, and since we're there now, it would be a de facto and very real victory for them if we should withdraw completely. I think Bush would have been impeached, aside from the fact that he would not have tolerated not attacking. He would have been impeached if we hadn't.
Yeah, excellent questions. First, there's no doubt that in the 1980s, we helped to build the Frankenstein monster of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda because, in fact, RCA was funding a lot of their operations against the Soviet Army. But after the Soviet Army collapsed, and especially in 92, after the Soviet-backed regime that they tried to leave behind collapsed, much of that energy for al-Qaeda was beginning to dissipate. It was actually kind of collapsing and melting away, and it was really the presence and the continued sustained presence year after year after year of our combat forces on the Arabian Peninsula that made it possible for Osama to go around and keep al-Qaeda together and then to refocus it on us. It took years. It didn't happen right away. And the reason it took years is because it wasn't clear until the mid-90s that our combat forces were going to stay. You see, we never made this public decision to go to the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia and other countries on the rim, and then just stay there year after year after year. Bill Clinton would occasionally talk about us removing our combat forces. But the fact is, by the mid-1990s, it became clear we really were going to stay onshore. And in 95, we had the first al-Qaeda suicide attacks in Saudi Arabia. Now, I'm not saying for a moment that after 9/11, we shouldn't have toppled the Taliban. It's too easy to say or to think that we have this simple choice between escalating troops in Muslim countries versus leaving or isolating ourselves or cutting and running.
That's not the only choice.
Those aren't the only choices, and I think it's kind of a false dichotomy, so to speak. In fact, I believe that most often we're best served by a third option. I call it offshore balancing, mm-hmm. where we rely on air power, naval power, not ground forces stationed in country, but bases that we could use to rapidly deploy troops if necessary, and then working with local allies. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is exactly the strategy we used to topple the Taliban.
Northern Alliance.
We did is we took 500 soldiers, married it with our air power, and then the Northern Alliance, mm-hmm. and we toppled the Taliban when it controlled 90% of the country. And then after toppling the Taliban, we ran them out of the country and ran al-Qaeda out of the country.
And then isn't it correct then that what happened then was Mr. Karzai comes to power? And the corruption of Mr. Karzai, and how did that play into what followed?
What happened is that for the first 2 years of after we toppled the Taliban, we did put in a few thousand combat soldiers, but they were mainly limited to Kabul. We were just occupying Kabul, and we were nervous that Karzai might be toppled. But then in October 2003, the UN gave us a mandate to expand our occupation to the rest of Afghanistan. And NATO, and in fact, we have the maps of this, NATO developed a very simple plan for occupying the rest of the country. 2004, you go to the north. Well, those are our allies, our friends, Northern Alliance, right? 2005, you go to the west, more friends. And then in early 2006, that's when we finally started to put large numbers of combat soldiers into the south and the east, which are the Pashtun homelands. And if you look at the rise of IED attacks and you look at the rise of suicide attacks, you'll see a spike. You won't see a steady, smoothly inclining curve. You'll see that they're very, very low until 2006 when they go up 10 times.
Marty Garrity, what would have happened politically if the president had said, you know what, I read Robert Pape's book, the 2005 book that he wrote, and I've decided that even though I said in my campaign that Afghanistan was the good war, we're pulling out right now. What would have happened politically?
That's a good question. We really don't have enough people in Congress who would have said, we've got to impeach this guy, as I think Art has said earlier, it would have happened with Bush had he not gone after the Taliban in 2001, actually. But there certainly would have been a great reaction against that, and essentially the people would have been outraged at, I think, would have been outraged at having this guy who said this was the war that we have to fight, then saying we're not going to fight it, and in effect we are going to allow the Taliban to go back in there. I don't think he could have survived the heat. He might have survived the politics, but I don't think he could have survived the heat from making a decision like that.
1-800-723-8289. We've got some callers on the line. We will get to you after our break. Stay with us. This is Beyond the Beltway, coming to you tonight from Chicago.
Announcing the Ally Bank online savings account with a rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at allybank.com or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward. Member FDIC.
Nowadays, when I talk with folks, they know GEICO could save them hundreds on their car insurance. But what they want to know is how GEICO does it. Well, I say, we got tons of great discounts, like good driver discounts, multi-car discounts. And they say, there's no secret formula. And I say, nah, it's just what we do. And then sometimes they say, maybe a talking gecko's a secret. Well, I wouldn't know what to say about that.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
We are back tonight on Beyond the Beltway, coming to you live from Chicago. I'm John Dempsey, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Bruce seems to have what's going around these days. He could barely talk when we spoke on the phone. So I'm in for Bruce. He will be back next week. And we're talking tonight about Afghanistan. And we've got a distinguished panel here. Marty Garrity, longtime friend of this program. Marty is a commercial real estate executive, and you are with the Garrity Group in Chicago. I'm guessing that you founded the Garrity Group.
This is the truth, yes.
Yes. I pieced these facts together.
One of its more eminent members.
Exactly, one of the more eminent members. Art Sear is with us tonight, and he is the Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Art is a graduate of UCLA, got a PhD with a distinction in political science from Harvard. And how long have you been at Carthage College?
About 10 years, a little over 10 years.
And we welcome you to the program tonight.
Thank you.
And Robert Pape is with us, a distinguished professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He specializes in international security affairs. I mentioned the book that he wrote 2005 called Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. He also, as Bob mentioned, he's got a new book coming out in September of 2010. It's called After Iraq, Stopping the Spread of Anti-American Suicide Terrorism. So, Bob, we welcome you to the program tonight. Let's go to the phones. Robert has been listening to us in Springfield, Illinois, on the Internet. Good evening, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call. I have sort of an assumption to put up for consideration, and I would preface that considering this seemingly multi-tiered chess game and my lack of knowledge and all the intricacies to the possibilities. It wouldn't even qualify as a hypothesis, so I let you guys do all the details. But considering all the needles that the president had to thread, I think he did pretty good, because I think he did a simple process. When I stepped back and finally, you know, came out of my dizziness, I looked back and I thought, wow, he did the most logical thing, and he kind of put something in there for everyone. And I think in the end game, it was just disingenuousness, because basically he left it open. I really don't think we're going to pull out. I don't think on a certain date we're going to pull our troops. I think that's going to be an end game that he can change. But do you think possibly that this process he used by stamping that date on there, that possibly the Taliban or the people in Afghanistan will actually sit back and maybe hang low for the next year or so until that pullout day, and it might result in him looking better, not having so many, such a high death count and so many problems, and that way, you know, we can kind of look at the economy and other things while, you know, we just kind of have a few incidences here and there.
That's a great question.
That's a good question, a frequently asked,
Art's here.
Frequently asked question. And Bob Gates, who is not only the only cabinet minister to stay over in the same job, from one party to another, at least since World War II, the defense secretary, his very effective answer is, I hope they do, because our mission is to train, to build infrastructure and to train indigenous
police. Gates said he hopes they do lay low until 2011.
Which is a good answer. And the caller also gets at the point, and why I thought of Nixon's ghost. The president's buying time. He's buying some breathing room politically and some maneuver room overseas as well as at home. And to me, it's very reminiscent of Nixon's strategy, which worked. The North Vietnamese Army in their final blitzkrieg in 1975 overran the country, but we don't, thank God, have that kind of problem to worry about in Afghanistan. And in terms of destroying what was left, which was very little of the VC after Tet, and destroying basically small independent North Vietnamese Army units in South Vietnam, the Nixon strategy was very, very effective, implemented by General Abrams.
Marty?
There's a new poll out that shows that something like 60% of Americans are glad or like the idea of getting out of Afghanistan or beginning to get out of Afghanistan in 2011, mm-hmm. but 30% or 35% think it was a mistake to say so, and I think they're right. You know, basically, I don't have a great problem with his effort to get out as soon as we can. Nobody wants us to be at war anywhere. But to say that to those guys, sure, they're going to lay low. And Gates is simply not telling the truth. If he really thinks it's good for them to lay low, to lie low, forgive me, what he's really meaning is that'll give us a reason to get out of there. And then that bloodbath that you're talking about that happened in Vietnam will happen in Afghanistan.
He also said 2 to 4 years, they have a tremendous amount of maneuver room. They're going to start withdrawing after 18 months.
But the problem was simply saying July of 2011.
Marty, what would have been the reaction among the left-leaning supporters of the president had he not given this July 2011 date?
They would have fulminated and been very irritated, and they could have done and would have done nothing.
But
he doesn't have to go to them for another 3 years. What he's done is he's made them marginally happy with that. He's made the Taliban extremely happy because they know they can lie low now and come back in when the very fact that they're lying low is evidence that the issue has been resolved. They can hang low, stay low, and then when we pull out, they'll come in and we will have another Vietnam if we don't aggressively go after them, and we probably can't.
What do you think, Robert Pape, about the announcement of July 2011?
I think that it makes eminently good domestic political sense in the United States in the short term, but unfortunately the real logic that matters is whether or not it will reduce the threat in the medium term. And the problem that we have is that we have essentially a contradiction in the president's strategy. The contradiction is that the problem we face from the Taliban is so severe, so significant, we've got to rapidly put in this significant number of troops, but it's not so significant or so important that we shouldn't stay there as long as
necessary. Did you think that was a political sop to the
well,
left?
Well, I'm afraid that one of the things that's very interesting about triangulation, this was what was speculated about beforehand. That's a term that comes from the Clinton administration. And George Stephanopoulos, if you go back and read his first book, you'll see that he actually says something interesting about what triangulation means, which means not just that you cut that distance halfway between your the political positions, but that you get to 60% of domestic political support. That the real measure of whether or not you succeeded in triangulation, again, is getting above 60%, whatever the collection of policies you have to get, no matter how contradictory, to get to 60%. And I'm afraid that this looks a little like the Stephanopoulos rule for triangulation, which isn't to say that I'm not going to be surprised that the American public is after all, this is the president of the United States. We are patriotic. I want to support the president here. I mean, the real issue here, I'm afraid, is does it actually advance our security? Will it really diminish the threat over time? And again, I'm trying to point out that we've done this before in Afghanistan over the last few years. We've been doing this again and again and again. And what I mean by that is we have been doing a series of incremental additions of 20+ thousand troops each year. This is now the fourth time since 2006. And each time, a year later, we've come back and we've said we need more troops.
But they've stayed undercover. In this particular case, the people that he's putting in charge, Petraeus and McChrystal, are saying they're not going to stay undercover the way these other people did.
Well,
we're going to emulate the Iraq effort, maybe not geographically wide an area, but we're going to emulate that effort and put them out where, I mean, McChrystal said today or earlier this week, the protection of the people. If we don't protect the people, we're not doing the job. And protection of the people has not been the mission of those people that have gone in previous years.
I think the Iraq surge worked, but we're applying the wrong lessons from the Iraq surge. The Iraq surge was really two things. It was something in Baghdad and something in Anbar province. In Baghdad, and if you go back and read President Bush's speech on the surge, which I just did a few days ago, I think you'll see that it is dramatically more precise and clear than what Obama's speech was. And you'll see that President Bush laid out the surge in Iraq as solving Baghdad. And what was happening in Baghdad in the fall of 2006 was a ethnic war between the Sunnis and the Shia in Baghdad. That's where all the really large numbers of deaths were, but
right.
In Baghdad.
Right.
Okay. And this would be akin in Afghanistan if we had Tajiks fighting with Pashtuns or if we had Haziris fighting with Tajiks. We don't have
that. So the Sunni versus the Shia conflict, that runs counter to your theory about the foreign occupiers. They weren't fighting each other because of the foreign occupiers.
No, but they saw each other as foreign occupiers.
Right, right.
So,
okay.
So they were very different communities.
Moreover, your theory about this, about a foreign occupation causing suicide terrorism, kind of falls down in the fact that it hasn't happened in Iraq since 2006. They are way more controlled, more invaded, more occupied than they were, and yet the suicide bombings haven't been occurring.
The suicide terrorism in Iraq is a Sunni phenomenon. There are no Shia suicide terrorists in Iraq. Think about that for a moment. Okay, we have lots of Shia Islamic fundamentalists who are religious. 60% of the country is Shia, right? It's a Sunni phenomenon emanating out of Anbar province. As I said, there were two things that happened in the Iraq surge. One was in Baghdad, and the other was in Anbar. What happened in Anbar had nothing to do with the application of troops. We did not send more troops out to villages in Anbar. If you look at the troop numbers, they're basically flat during this thing called the surge because the troops actually went
to— But the strategy changed.
But what happened was we hired 100,000 Sunnis and put them on the payroll, and they became the sons of Iraq, who suddenly now had an interest in opposing basically the terrorists, and gaining political power for themselves. That's what really mattered in suppressing suicide terrorism in Iraq, and that's what we should be doing in Afghanistan.
Except that we pulled the rug out from those guys, too.
1-800-723-8289. We're going to take a break. This is Beyond the Beltway, coming to you tonight from Chicago.
Announcing the Ally Bank online savings account with the rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at allybank.com or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward. Member FDIC.
Get the good stuff!
Give the holiday gift that keeps on fixing. The 7-piece gear wrench ratcheting wrench set available at your local Napa Auto Parts store for just $29.99. A savings of 70%. These versatile combination wrenches work in tight spaces while offering the speed of a ratchet. 7-piece gear wrench ratcheting wrench sets are available in SAE or metric sizes. Now for just $29.99 at Napa.
Napa.
Get the good!
1-800-723-8289 is our number. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway, coming to you tonight from Chicago. I'm John Dempsey, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Let's talk to Cheryl from the north side of Chicago, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Good evening, Cheryl.
Good evening to you. No matter what the reason was for 9/11, or even what the exit date is, we should now focus on destroying the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda by hitting them with enough air power to put an end to their terrorism and extremism. And that's, I believe that's where we should got to go with air power. Bring our men home whenever we can, and increase our air power to destroy the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Thank you, Cheryl. Can we do that if they're hiding in the mountains?
The problem with air power is that it is so nonspecific. Every time we send in a drone that drops a bomb on a house or on a car or whatever, 12 children
kids,
end
yeah.
up as bodies. And it's the rare air attack that has occurred there that hasn't been a PR disaster for us, whether we deserve it or not. Even when we kill a bad guy or two or three or 10, there are always two or three children or pregnant ladies who get killed. And that it just doesn't work as an effective counterterrorism activity for popular consumption.
Bob, you've written frequently and extensively about the use of air power. Can it be targeted so we don't kill innocent people?
Well, and I also spent 3 years teaching for the U.S. Air Force in the 1990s on conventional air strategy. I think that Marty there's a lot to what Marty says, but I think the conclusions go in the opposite direction he's pushing them. You see, if he's worried about collateral damage from the few drone attacks that we've had, and we've had about 64 drone attacks in Pakistan from 2004 to 2009, killing 21 high-value targets. So that's the number. Those are the rough numbers. The problem that we have is that we use lots of tactical air power to defend our troops when we put our troops in harm's way. A good example of this was in September in Kunduz, which is a northern province in Afghanistan, where the Germans were trying to get some supplies, just some tankers with some fuel, into their base. And the Taliban came and attacked the tankers, and some Germans got killed in the course of this, so they called in helicopters. So we don't use drones in this case. We use lots and lots of helicopters, and the helicopters killed something like 100 civilians. At first, the military said, no, it wasn't. They were just all bad guys. Then the pictures came out, and now, if you've noticed in the news, the German officials have just resigned from the German government over this very issue. Because the problem is that you're right that there's issues of collateral damage, Marty, but they're much worse when you put in a large army, because there are just many, many more people we have to defend, and we'd want to defend them with, say, helicopters.
Let's talk to Jim in Northwest Indiana, listening to us on WLS. Good evening, Jim.
Yes, good evening. topic is everlasting, right?
Right.
But anyways, my point would be, when George Bush and Dick Cheney were so hot to trot for a war in Iraq. Now, you know, people have different opinions, but my opinion is the 9/11 Commission report, a bipartisan report that stated that Iraq had no link to 9/11. So we go in and kill, oh, I don't know, 100,000, you know, on the low side, half a million civilians, women, children, grandmas, grandpas, you know, on the high side. And then we wonder why they would have the audacity to be mad and upset about it and stirring terrorism. I would remind you that George Washington said, two keys to a strong America. Number one, Washington said, keep strong American borders. And General Washington said, two, stay out of other countries' wars and squabbles. Now, DOD.gov, Department of Defense, states America has a military presence in 137 different countries, and I want to just, you know, petition myself on that. I don't want nothing to do with that because I'm a Christian.
Jim, did you vote for Barack Obama?
Well, I did, but my main choice would have been Dennis Kucinich.
So you did the fact that Obama called Afghanistan the good war, that you voted for Obama in spite of that, correct?
Well, he, to my knowledge, he said that's a good war after I already voted for him.
Okay.
So my money was already spent, but there's no good war.
Jim, thank
you. Why do we have a military in 137 countries? Is it that profitable to kill innocent people all around the world?
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Art Sear.
I agree in spirit with a lot of what the questioner says. Another president who is first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, as Nixon said in his eulogy to Dwight Eisenhower, was Ike. I'm very glad we're getting around to building a monument to Eisenhower in Washington. I think he was the greatest president since World War II. Eisenhower said, first, any damn fool can start a war. It doesn't take any brains to start a war. What's far more difficult is to end a war, especially for a democracy on terms that are reasonable for us. And the toughest challenge of all is to protect your national interest and maintain public cohesion without going to war at all. He also warned in his farewell address about the military-industrial complex. Bob Woodward has done four books on the George W. Bush administration, phenomenally revealing, as far as I know, nothing he said has ever been discredited. He quotes Rumsfeld. He had tremendous access, despite his criticism of the White House. Rumsfeld is saying right after the 9/11 attacks, there are no good targets in Afghanistan. Iraq, we got plenty of targets. We got plenty of targets in Iraq. No war was ever won by air power alone, but there are very powerful interests that are pushing for use of heavy weapons around the world.
What is our exit strategy in Afghanistan, in your opinion?
Well, I hope, as Gates implies, that in a few years we can withdraw. The British, it's widely known now, faced disasters in Afghanistan in the 1800s, but through a combination of an extraordinarily ruthless and effective disciplined military power in the 1880s, and bribery and fairly cynical manipulation of competing indigenous interests, they were able to establish a fairly friendly regime that lasted up into World War II. I think that example, that history, is very instructive for us.
That's Professor Art Sear from Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. We're also here tonight with conservative Marty Garrity and Robert Pape, the political scientist from the University of Chicago. We will be back after the top of the hour. Stay with us. We want to hear from you. 1-800-723-8289. This is Beyond the Beltway.
The best age for your child to learn to read is during the first 5 years of life. Kathleen discovered this fact firsthand.
A friend of ours recommended the Your Baby Can Read series when we had our first child, Jacob. Never thought anything of it. We plopped him down in front of it.
Your Baby Can Read worked amazingly well.
When Jacob was 3 years old, he was reading at second grade level. He turned five in July, went to kindergarten, and in 3 weeks he was moved to first grade.
Kathleen knows it's no coincidence.
Because we have three children and all are reading on a high level, school is very easy. Straight A students, maybe one or two children, but all three. probably a successful video. So bam, it worked.
Did Kathleen have to work at it?
No, I didn't have to do a thing. Your baby can read definitely gives them a life skill that can never be taken away from them. It's been invaluable.
For a limited time, you can receive a completely risk-free trial of the Your Baby Can Read program. Call now and we'll also include three free learning gifts with your risk-free trial. Call 1-800-508-3105. 800-508-3105. 800-508-3105.
Announcing the Ally Bank online savings account with the rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at allybank.com or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward. Member FDIC.
Hey, that stack of money over there with the googly eyes, is that the money you could be saving with Geico?
It's the money I am saving with Geico. He helped me buy this pool table.
Nice. So what else does he do? Can he tell jokes?
Seriously, Kevin, he's a stack of money. He doesn't tell jokes. He just blinks and buys me stuff.
Well, I just thought...
Money can't talk. That's ridiculous. Why do you always take it too far?
Me?
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Get the good stuff!
This year, Napa has great holiday deals on gifts any handyman will truly appreciate. Choose from a durable 9-piece combination wrench set or a 42-piece SAE and metric socket set for just $9.55 each. The 42-piece socket set includes quarter-inch and 3/8-inch drives to help tackle any job. Stop by your local Napa Auto Parts store today and check out these great holiday deals.
Napa!
Get the good stuff!
I'm Mark Galbarian, president of Goldline. Call Goldline today at 800-913-GOLD. And let us show you how you can acquire gold that's shipped directly to you. That's gold you can hold in your hand, not some paper promise. You receive free shipping on your first order, and there's no sales tax. The number to call is 800-913-GOLD. Call now, and we'll send you a free brochure, newsletter, and DVD. Don't wait to get this valuable information. Call 800-913-GOLD. 800-913-GOLD.
Live from Chicago, I'm John Dempsey in for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by conservative Marty Garrity, Art Sear of Carthage College, and Robert Pape of the University of Chicago. Our program tonight coming to you from the XM Sirius Studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free phone lines are now open. We want to hear from you at 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. We are talking tonight about Afghanistan. This past week, the president announced a surge of 30,000 troops to begin after the first of the year, and in July of 2011, he will begin the process of pulling those troops out. So there's a lot of opinion on what the president said this week. Is it a good move? Is it a bad move? Was it a bad move to announce our end date? And we've been talking about the politics of it and the internal politics, Art Sear, in Afghanistan. How popular or unpopular are the Taliban in Afghanistan?
Well, I think we should be skeptical of any public opinion poll from Afghanistan and some other parts of the world, but there is a lot of polling going on, and the BBC, CBS, and some other serious media are pretty consistent in finding that their support is nil, 2 to 4%, which is very different from the way the situation developed in Vietnam, which we've been talking about. Beyond hard data, though, there's extraordinarily positive inferential evidence or anecdotal evidence off the battlefield. An awful lot of the talking about an honest election in the context of Afghanistan, to me, is in itself revolutionary progress. A large percentage of the poll watchers and those who were keeping an eye on things were women. The rise of women in Afghanistan from zero or less than zero influence to an increasingly active role is significant. Among them is one of the many benefits of being around young people at my stage in life is the growing proportion at our campus, as in all others, of foreign students. We have a young woman from Afghanistan who's surmounted terrible experiences, is very much a leader at the college. Given my responsibilities for our Clausen Center, I tend to meet a lot of the foreign students.
That's Carthage College in Kenosha,
yeah,
Wisconsin.
And she talks about the pervasiveness of cell phones and televisions, even out in the bush, and travels back there. There is a network of communication that really is quite revolutionary and is a big reason why the world is moving in our direction. David Brooks, the conservative columnist at the New York Times, has spoken very persuasively and eloquently about how, partly because the UN is there with us, you have all kinds of service organizations and relief and help and development and educational activity going on that he says is a striking contrast with Iraq.
So you are of the – go ahead,
that's Mike. The sort of thing that goes on really in parallel to the government of – to the Karzai government, which we hear is very corrupt and things
incompetent,
are
incompetent, inefficient.
Right. But the reality is, 40 years ago, I was a political science graduate, and we were learning that corruption is endemic. I mean, that's what happens in India and in South America.
Even in Chicago.
Not in Chicago. Never. But never in Chicago.
I didn't know you were a political science graduate. Oh, I knew there was something I really liked about you.
But there is something special about...
My point is, the key is to focus on corruption and say, well, for that reason, it's a bad government. We shouldn't have anything to do with Karzai. There's no alternative to that. You are going to have people who help their brothers do whatever they want to do, who pay off the local chieftain to get a building permit or whatever it is that they're trying to do. And you can't say, oh, until we have the exquisite perfection of Chicago politics or Milwaukee politics
or Minnesota,
whatever, we won't do anything. We can't work with these people. That's crazy, because if that's your standard, you will work with no one.
What do you think about that?
There's something special about what's happening to the corruption with the corruption in Afghanistan. It has to do with the Constitution. You see, in 2004, we installed a new constitution in Afghanistan. Yes, it's true, there was a loyal Yerga which voted for it, but we were also manipulating that, or at least had a lot to do with that vote. And the constitution itself was essentially written in Washington, large parts of it in the White House. And what's unusual about that constitution is it's unusual because it is a democratic constitution, calls for elections, but it gives the president unchecked power in Afghanistan. There's no check and balance system. And notice how it's a winner-take-all system. So the president has all the power. And notice how in this recent fiasco of the election here, Karzai didn't have to answer to a Supreme Court. He didn't have to answer to a parliament. Why? Well, if you go and read the 2004 Constitution, the Supreme Court in Afghanistan has no power to balance. And it's even worse than that, Marty, because what it also gives the power to the president to pick the provincial governors and the district governors, which would be like President Obama picking the governor of Illinois or the mayor of Chicago. So what's happening is it's not just – yes, you're right. Corruption is a fact of life in many countries, including some of our very, very close to home. But it's made worse by a particularly centralized constitution.
Is it your position then that the people in Afghanistan are running to the arms of the Taliban because they detest the Karzai administration so much?
Yes, I think they're running to the arms of the Taliban because, see, for 150 years, all the previous ways of running Afghanistan, the previous constitutions, have been bottom-up, decentralized. What this constitution did for the first time in Afghanistan's history is a top-down, very heavy-handed power, centralizing power in the hands of one person, the president. And that president, Karzai, he has used it to pick governors to his personal advantage, and that is making it actually quite easy for the Taliban to approach others in different provinces and say, ally with us, we'll help you work against Karzai. And that's creating this huge problem of illegitimacy and also pushing people toward the Taliban.
How about Marty's position that you can't wait for, like, the Portland, Oregon City Council style of government to be in Kabul before you try to come in there and do something?
Well, what I think would be a more – someone asked earlier, what's a more kind of effective exit strategy? And I think one of the key points that we don't see would be constitutional reform. If you really wanted to have maximum leverage on the Karzai government, a phrase that Obama is apparently using inside of his councils, what that should mean is actual constitutional reform inside of Afghanistan. The problem was we wrote the Constitution in a way that would help us manage Afghanistan efficiently, because then we'd only have to deal with Karzai. This isn't very this was just simply misguided, and it would be a better idea to actually have constitutional reform that would kind of move closer to the bottom up system that Afghanistan has always had.
So you think we should do nation building? We need to reject the Constitution we imposed earlier. We've got to impose another.
I think what we should be doing is withholding the imposition of more troops until we have a constitution that could actually lead to a legitimate government. I'm not saying we should withdraw our troops. I'm saying that what we should do is we should tell Karzai, look, if you want more troops, then what we need to do is move toward a truly legitimate
government.
Impose
a new constitution is what you're saying.
Well, we're going to take a break.
That's not nation building?
We're going to answer that question after our break. 1-800-723-8289. This is Beyond the Beltway from Chicago.
Announcing the Ally Bank online savings account with the rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at allybank.com or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward. Member FDIC.
Get the good stuff!
Give the holiday gift that keeps on fixing. The 7-piece gear wrench ratcheting wrench set available at your local Napa Auto Parts store for just $29.99. A savings of 70%. These versatile combination wrenches work in tight spaces while offering the speed of a ratchet. 7-piece gear wrench ratcheting wrench sets are available in SAE or metric sizes. Now for just $29.99 at Napa.
Napa.
Get the good!
We are back live from Chicago on Beyond the Beltway tonight. I'm John Dempsey sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We're talking about Afghanistan. We're going to get back to calls in just a second. 1-800-723-8289. Marty Garrity, you made the point about nation building, and you said off air that it's a good idea. You like nation building.
There's a great scene in the first Indiana Jones movie where he's just come out of a terrible fight with five or six different whirling dervishes or whoever they are. And another guy comes up to him, and he's exhausted. And another guy comes up and starts waving his sword around and doing this elaborate, magnificent dance. And Indiana Jones just looks at him and pulls out his gun and shoots the guy. Just boom, he's dead. And that ends it. My point is, guns are really good. If you want to achieve a good, and then Indy uses that, the death of this guy with the fancy sword work, to go save the girl or save the whatever he did. Guns are really good for that sort of thing. And we need to use our guns to create a circumstance in which a nation can be built in Afghanistan that actually fulfills most all of our aspirations for nations. But the first thing you have to do is create the conditions, because if Indiana Jones didn't have the gun, somebody would have shot Indiana, and then the good guy would be dead. And we're going to be dead if we're not prepared to use our guns and use them early to achieve whatever we need to achieve to create the conditions which will permit a nation to be built there.
Let's talk about Pakistan. An argument has been made that if we drive the Taliban out of Afghanistan, they will go into Pakistan. There's already a presence there in the border region between the two countries. Pakistan is a weakened state. How big of a problem, Artsir, is Pakistan right now?
Well, potentially it's a gigantic problem off the charts, because Pakistan has nuclear weapons and has a very large fundamentalist movement. However, please keep in mind that Pakistan has a very powerful military tradition that directly reflects our British friends. John Foster Dulles, who kept busy trying to recreate NATO around the world, thought Pakistan was so important, and therefore his boss Ike did as well, that Pakistan was part of the Southeast Asia as well as Central Treaty Organizations. Those are dead letters now. That's not the point. The point is they're an extremely important strategic ally of the United States. We're so focused in our current puritanical period on corruption and legitimate governments. To me, it's remarkably encouraging that they have something like reasonable elections by our standards. Musharraf, a traditional military strongman in some ways, stepped down and faces prosecution, but he stepped down because he lost the election. All of that is extremely encouraging, and I'm confident, especially given the Obama administration's, to me, surprising willingness to pick a special operations type like McChrystal for Afghanistan. I'm sure there's a lot going on that isn't in the news, shouldn't be in the news, and I hope stays out in the news, and in the very touchy provinces bordering Afghanistan. So I'm encouraged.
Let's go to Jerry in Redding, California, listening to us on KQMS. Hi, Jerry. Jerry?
Yes, hello.
Good evening.
Good to talk with you.
Good evening.
Yes, the reason I'm calling is this. I'm a volunteer at our library here in Reading, and I came across a brand new book that the ink was still drying on. And in that book, it talked about a location where Osama bin Laden might really be, and it's not near the Afghan-Pakistan border. And as you just mentioned, Osama bin Laden had made statements suggesting the overthrow of Musharraf. So we know that Osama bin Laden has enemies in Pakistan, and he's not really safe there. He may be in this special place in Afghanistan. So when I've attempted to communicate with the CIA, the Central Command, or even with the office of Secretary Robert Gates, I always get the public information officer, and they say, well, don't call us, we'll call you.
We'll get back to you.
Yeah, and to this date, there is no evidence that they have ever looked for him in that particular location. Now, rather than give this out across the airwaves, after the program or at some time, if someone would call me on a line, I'll be glad to tell the book, the page number, and there are a couple other places they mentioned where nuclear materials are being transferred from the Soviet Union down into Afghanistan and so forth.
What's the name of the book? Just tell us the name of the book. Can you tell us that?
I would be glad to tell someone who would call me back, not on the air.
You don't want to say it on the air. Okay.
I tell you what, I've learned that I don't think we can trust a whole lot of people in this country.
All right. Jerry, thank you.
I'm sorry about that. But I gave your person there, your office person, my phone number, mm-hmm. and I'll hang up. And,
okay.
And I've seriously questioned, do they really want to get Osama bin Laden?
All right. Jerry, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Bob, listening to us on WLS. Bob is in the great western suburb of Naperville, Illinois. Hi, Bob.
What a great show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, how enlightening and how wonderful it is to listen to you and the people the panel you have on tonight is just wow. And thank you very much.
Phone all your friends and family and tell them to listen, Bob.
Call often, Bob.
As you know, the one thing I love to hear is the analytical, reasoned approach. And when you use – and God we trust, everybody else has to use numbers. And I love Dr. Pape's – and is it Dr. Pape? Am I –
Yes. Thanks, Bob.
I love the approach of using the numbers and looking at it and seeing what the numbers tell us. And one of the things that I heard said, and that is kind of my thing, is that nobody's really talking about the white elephant in the room. And that is Israel. You had mentioned that a lot of the suicide attacks were in the West Bank,
mm-hmm.
and that they were made because people felt that they were occupied. And to me, that's very clear. And it's also clear to me that Osama bin Laden, back in his original declaration of war in 96, made it very clear that of his disdain for the Israel-U.S. connection. And he made that clear again here in September. That he had a high disdain for the U.S. So my question kind of comes is that how much could we help ourselves, if you will, by getting behind the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative and saying that, you know, maybe we could win back the Arabs if we said, you know what, let's stop occupying the West Bank. Let's move everybody back to the 1967 lines. Everybody gets recognized then, and Israel becomes a functional part of the Middle East with full recognition and full trade status. And if we made that push, and again, it's really tough to speak out without feeling like you're going to be labeled an anti-Semite, but no one supports them stepping in and settling in the West Bank.
That's a great question. Let's ask Robert Pape that question.
Bob, I certainly think that Israel's security would be better off with better policies toward the West Bank. And in fact, of all Israel's leaders in the last few years who actually had, I think, the best policy, Sharon, of all people, in 2004, when he decided to unilaterally withdraw from Gaza and big parts of the West Bank, that's what really brought the Second Intifada to an end. And that dramatically improved Israel's security through that step. Now, that said, I really don't think Israel is at the centerpiece of what's driving Osama bin Laden. I do believe that it's part of his rhetoric. I think it's there as a secondary issue, but I don't think it's the centerpiece. And why is that? Bin Laden's been behind about 30 suicide and other major attacks since 1995. Not a single one has been directed at Israel proper. If it really was the case that it was Israel directly at the center of it, we just would have expected much, much more energy.
Hasn't bin Laden gone after Israel?
Because I think bin Laden is much more focused on the Arabian Peninsula. He's interested in the military presence of foreigners, that is, Americans and other Westerners, on Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Yemen, other countries in the Arabian Peninsula, Iraq, of course. And I think that for him, this is a kind of a combination of religion and nationalism coming together in the Arabian Peninsula. And so I see that as his center of gravity, which isn't to say that he doesn't use anti-Israeli rhetoric all the time. I'm afraid that that's sort of, for bin Laden, speaking to the median voter in the region. We don't necessarily like to, you know, talk about it quite that crudely, but I'm afraid that being at least moderately, if not more extremely, anti-Israel is a kind of a normal state of affairs for folks in that region.
Let's go, Marty Garrity.
Bin Laden is not a fellow who cares about Saudi national politics or Afghan national politics. Islamism, radical Islamism, is about extending the caliphate across the entire world.
Well,
and to the extent that the United States represents, the United States and Israel and the rest of the Western world, represents a rejection of this theology, that we are bad guys. It's not what we do. It's who we are. We are non-Muslims. We are infidels. We're non-believers, whatever. We must be killed. And it's not about whether we have an extra 1,000 troops on the border with Gaza or whatever.
So your point runs counter to Bob's, that even if we pulled our troops out of every Muslim nation, they would still hate us and want to kill us.
Absolutely.
Marty, one of the things that's kind of interesting, 2 weeks ago I spent a week in Libya because Gaddafi's son, who may someday be the next ruler of leader in Libya, asked me and a few journalists to come to spend time interviewing terrorists that the Libyans have just released. And these were folks who went to Afghanistan in the 1990s. They spent time with Osama bin Laden in the camps. And we spent 10 hours interviewing them and at great length about their views on doing terrorism and terrorist attacks. And one of the things that was really quite clear is they had a fairly clear framework for how to become a martyr, get all the benefits of martyrdom, which was they could only do it if they were fighting non-Muslims to protect Muslims. Yes, it's true, they might also like to create a Muslim state, but the problem was you couldn't become a martyr that way because there are so many different variants of Sharia. You'd necessarily have to have Muslims fighting Muslims, and therefore you couldn't become a martyr that way. So it's not that that aspiration may not be there at all. It doesn't lead to suicide attacks against us.
Let's take a break. This is Beyond the Beltway coming to you from Chicago.
Announcing the Ally Bank online savings account with a rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at allybank.com or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward, member FDIC.
Shaquille O'Neal for Icy Hot.
I need pain relief that won't mess with my grip.
The new Icy Hot No Mess Applicator. Powerful, targeted, long-lasting pain relief now in a roll-on applicator. No mess. Just maximum strength medicine for back, shoulders, knees, even arthritis. Massages in icy to dull the pain, hot to relax it away.
Wherever I hurt, wherever I go.
Stop pain right at the source with the new Icy Hot No Mess Applicator.
No pain, no mess.
For temporary topical pain relief, use only as directed.
We are back tonight on Beyond the Beltway, coming to you live from Chicago. I'm John Dempsey, sitting in tonight for Bruce Dumont. Bruce is under the weather. He will be back next week. Our guests tonight are conservative Marty Garrity. Marty is a longtime guest of this program. He's a commercial real estate executive with the Garrity Group in Chicago. Is real estate ever going to come back?
Oh, let's hope so, but it's certainly not next week or next month. We are in a real trough.
A long, hard slog. Art Sear is with us. Art is the Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is north of Chicago. And Art authored the book After the Cold War, American Foreign Policy, Europe and Asia. Art, you wrote that book in 1997 and revised it in 2000, right?
Yes, thank you very much. And it still sells. So
it still
sells.
Thank
you very much for mentioning it. I really should write another one at this point.
And speaking of books, Robert Pape is with us. He is a political science professor at the University of Chicago. He specializes in international security affairs. And we've been talking a lot tonight about his book, which has gotten worldwide acclaim, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, written in 2005, in which Professor Pape made the point that the reason suicide attacks happen is in Muslim countries is that the attackers are upset about the presence of foreign fighters, infidels, on their land. And you've got a new book coming out, Professor, in September of 2010, After Iraq, Stopping the Spread of Anti-American Suicide Terrorism. How do we stop it?
Well, we need to recognize that the two options on the table, cutting and running, that is just simply withdrawing from key territories around the world, or escalating our military presence, both of those options are really not in our best interest. The fact of the matter is, in most regions of the world, we're there because we have important interests. On the Arabian Peninsula, we're there because oil. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're there, for instance, and not in the center of Africa. We're obviously interested in Afghanistan because of the presence of al-Qaeda there and the fear that there will be a safe haven that they could use to. And those, but those are limited interests. Those are not all-encompassing interests. Those are interests that we can achieve often with a more modest military approach. That military approach I call offshore balancing, which relies on air power, naval power, close alliances with local allies who we should work with economic tools, political tools, and yes, in extremis, rapidly deployable ground forces, but not permanently stationing onshore ground forces in these regions. And that, I think, will substantially diffuse the threat we face.
And you talked about in the early days of the Afghan war, the Northern Alliance did a lot of our dirty work for us. We attacked from the air and they were on the ground.
Exactly right. And we've used the strategy of offshore balancing to great effect to serve our interests. In 2001, the Taliban controlled 90% of Afghanistan. There were numerous, not just little itty-bitty camps by al-Qaeda, but if your listeners would ever go to Google Images and just Google Tarnak Farms, you can see what Osama bin Laden's camp, his core camp, looked like. It's a campus bigger than the University of Chicago campus. It's a base. This isn't some little itty-bitty thing. And the fact of the matter is, even with all that infrastructure, even with all that control by the Taliban, we deployed 500 of our ground troops. We used lots of our air power. And we worked with the Northern Alliance. And within 6 weeks, we toppled the Taliban. And within another month, we ran the Taliban out of the country. And the truth is, we basically made Afghanistan quite safe for American interests until we began to put in tens of thousands of ground troops all around the country starting in 2005 and 2006.
And Marty, what do you think about that argument that Bob is making, that the violence in Afghanistan, the instability started after we began sending in more and more troops over the past several years?
It depends on the assumption that the Islamic jihad is nationalistic. It isn't about a worldwide effort to extend Islam as the world religion. It's about this country or that country. And that's your fundamental assumption there just doesn't stand up. That's not what these folks are about. They are absolute true believers in God's call for them to bring Islam to the entire world, and even if it means imposing on it. And so the notion that somehow they wouldn't be mad at us if we only had 10,000 troops on the ground in Afghanistan,
in your line of thinking, it doesn't matter where we have our troops. It's they hate us because of who we are and what we stand
That's
for.
That's correct. And they'll come after us regardless.
Well, and I mean, what I would say is that we can actually test this in the data now, because you see, what I do with the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism is I have a research team of about a dozen people. I mentioned this has been funded by the Defense Department numerous times. Well, we don't just collect a little bit of statistics. We actually collect statistics on thousands of suicide terrorist attacks, including the 350 that have been occurred in Afghanistan. We actually know the identities, the names, the birthplaces, the ages, and other socioeconomic data of 84 of the Afghan suicide attackers, that is, individuals who have done a suicide attack in Afghanistan. We know 84 of them. And of those 84, 90% are Afghan citizens. 90%. 5% are coming from Tajikistan or other border regions of Afghanistan, and only 5% are coming from outside the zone of conflict. Moreover, if you look at the targets that they're attacking, 85% of those targets are NATO forces, U.S. or NATO troops.
Well, whom else would they attack? I mean,
they could be attacking civilians. They could be attacking.
85% of the automobile accidents that occur in Cook County involve people who live in Cook County. I'm not
well,
exactly
well, my
surprised
point, my point
by
to
that.
You is that I'm willing to accept that my my argument rests on the notion of nationalism. And what I'm telling you is that well over 90% of the suicide attackers are actually quite nationalist once we actually look at their identities and go person by person.
If we eliminate the suicide attacks in these Muslim countries, does that not change the fact that I think Marty is making, is that these people when I say these people, I mean the radical Muslim way of thinking, they still would love to come to this country and have another 9/11 and attack us again and murder even more of our citizens on our soil.
I think that as long as we're over there occupying key Muslim countries, the energy for them coming here to attack us is going to be real. However, I think that we have good evidence from other cases, such as Lebanon, that when you remove the foreign ground forces, the energy for suicide attacks dries up. I think we'd all agree Hezbollah is one of the famous suicide terrorist organizations. Well, in June 1982, Hezbollah didn't exist. But in June 82, Israel invaded southern Lebanon with 78,000 combat soldiers, 3,000 tanks and armored vehicles. 1 month later, Hezbollah was born. Then Israel stayed there for 18 years, and there were well over 40 Hezbollah suicide attacks during that period from 82 to 2000.
It's two per year.
And then Israel, well, they were clumpy, and we could get into the details. All right. But the point is that when Israel left after 2000, since then, there have been zero suicide attacks from Lebanon,
but
even during the summer of 2006, where we had a war.
Your fundamental assumption seems to be that suicide bombs or suicide bombings are the key problem, and they're really a fairly small aspect.
You mean the suicide bombings in the Muslim countries?
Suicide bombings, period. I mean, how many people have been killed by suicide bombings? Not that many. The Gaza missiles, the Golan Heights efforts. These are the things that are more, are way more destructive.
From
suicide bombing is a very interesting phenomenon, but it's not exactly cataclysmic.
From 2000 to 2004, during the Second Intifada, where there were lots of suicide attacks against Israel, over 1,000 Israelis died in that period.
Terrible.
Since then, there have been 7 who have died to rocket attacks out of Gaza. 7 in that 5-year period. So I don't mean to say that I'm not trying to truly say we shouldn't worry about even 7 people. What I am trying to say is the difference between 7 and 1,000 is rather stark.
I'm not saying 1,000 is not important, but life in southern Israel has been totally disrupted by even if the missiles are badly aimed, they're ducking under their table.
I don't mean to say for a moment that Israel should not have policies to deal with a threat to its country from the missiles. But I do mean to say that if people think they'd be better off going back to the Second Intifada of heavy occupation with ground forces of Gaza and the West Bank, I think they would be mistaken. It would be worse, not better.
And Israel is better off having given up its ability to control Gaza.
Yes. Israel is demonstrably safer. There are fewer Israelis dead today and dead since Israel left Gaza than before. 9/11 is another example of where suicide attack made all the difference. How do we know? Because in 1993, there was an ordinary attack by Ramzi Youssef, that is someone affiliated with al-Qaeda, on the very same World Trade Center tower. And that tower, that attack, was an ordinary bomb, set off in a parking garage in one of the towers, and it killed 6 people, not 3,000 people. So the element of suicide, really, I don't want to say it's everything, but it's like lung cancer. It's the biggest killer of the phenomenon.
Let's take a break on Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289. We'll get to phone calls after this break. Stay with us.
This year, Napa has great holiday deals on gifts any handyman will truly appreciate. Choose from a durable 9-piece combination wrench set or a 42-piece SAE and metric socket set for just $9.55 each. The 42-piece socket set includes quarter-inch and 3/8-inch drives to help tackle any job. Stop by your local Napa Auto Parts store today and check out these great holiday deals. Napa.
Get the good stuff.
It's quite a proposition when you think about it. You contact GEICO and you could save hundreds on your car insurance. 15 minutes, simple as that. Something they've been doing for over 70 years. You want car insurance and you want extra money in your wallet, done and done. Now, not only do you have some nice car insurance, you've got plenty of money to spend on some tasty biscuits. Or flowers for your mum. Or whatever it is you fancy.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
We are back tonight on Beyond the Beltway from Chicago. I'm John Dempsey, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Let's get to some of the patient callers who have been holding. Let's talk to Doug, listening to us in Normal, Illinois. Hi, Doug.
Hey, guys. Great program.
Thank you.
I want to get back to what another caller was discussing, and that is that all of these problems going from Lebanon to Iraq to Afghanistan to Pakistan to and now Iran, all derived from the problem with Israel and the Palestinians. And you know that after 9/11, Bush told us that the reason they attacked us on 9/11 was because they hate America or they hate democracy. But as you probably know, Osama bin Laden puts out these communiques about every 6 months. And in those communiques, he very clearly states that 9/11 was revenge for the support that the U.S. gave Israel in what he calls the genocide of the Palestinians. And these communiques continue, and now they're even getting a little more, he's even more frustrated. To paraphrase, I don't have the document in front of me, but to paraphrase one of his most recent ones, he said, "It's now been 5 years, and still the American people have not been told the truth." Okay, so if you could comment on the following. There's about 1.3 billion Muslims in the world who are mad at the USA because what they perceive as our support of the genocide against the Palestinians. So hence, let's diffuse this by solving the problem between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
That's a good question.
Yeah, I think that probably the best way to answer that is if you would just simply go to his 1998 fatwa, which you could easily find online, and it's only just a few pages long, you'll see that bin Laden in 98 lays out three grounds for why he should murder Americans. It's his, it's the key fatwa. It's his fatwa that, that explains why kill Americans, and he means to kill every adult male American, and he explains who he wants to kill. And he says number one is the occupation of the Arabian Peninsula, and he lays out his thinking there, and it's similar to what I've just described for you in my thinking of occupation. Number two is Iraq. The second biggest thing was in the 1990s, Iraq, and he says that American sanctions on Iraq have killed over 200,000 Iraqis. And what that shows is that Americans are not just simply occupying the Arabian Peninsula, but they mean to do harm to Muslims in their military occupation. And then number three is Israel, and he does talk about genocide, and your caller is quite right. And I don't mean to say it has no role here at all, but it's lower on the totem pole for him. And what he's doing is he's using it as another example of America's double standard, where America is willing to basically support policies that will do harm to Muslims and not treat Muslim life as co-equal with an American life or a Western life.
There are 1.3 billion, more or less, Muslims in the world. Fortunately, they are not all mad at us. Historically, there's been consistent, persistent efforts by individuals. Osama's the latest in that sense of a whole series who tried to become broad nationalist leaders. There was a fanatical religious zealot and charismatic, in some ways brilliant military leader named the Mahdi in the 1800s who went a long way towards achieving that goal, at least in North Africa. But since then, fortunately, you know, Gamal Nasser saw himself that way. Saddam Hussein, in a demented way apparently toward the end, saw himself that way. But it hasn't happened. I think what we can do is look for ways to divide, and in a positive sense, to divide off the most extreme elements from others. And there I think Marty's onto something in talking about looking at the big picture. And one practical future step might be to Bob's very effective and really quite brilliant disciplined research might be expanded into other populations. And I certainly hope the Pentagon and other funding sources are listening. But all kidding aside, Turkey, which was terribly alienated thanks to the George W. Bush administration, I think reemerges automatically as a extremely important country, partly because they've got a powerful emotional affinity for the U.S. dating back to the Korean War. That can be, it's, that's self-evident. It can be demonstrated unequivocally. And Obama, I think quite wisely on his Europe trip last summer, one of his first overseas trips, made a special point of going to Turkey and encouraging and underscoring the importance of that alliance. They are, of course, a Muslim country, but they're very much on our side, very much pro-U.S., dating especially from Korea, and there's an opportunity here for us. They're our only real ally outside of Israel in the region, and I think Marty's emphasis on the big picture really encourages us to look at these different elements. But fortunately, we don't have a unified Muslim opposition, no matter how many Osama T-shirts are sold in Muslim
Turkey
countries.
Turkey itself represents a country that is increasingly less civilian or less non-religious and more religious, and to the extent that it has traditionally been an ally of ours, it is that's moving away from that with respect to the extent that the religious forces in the country are becoming stronger.
I would disagree with that. There's a religious party that's been elected for the first time, a fundamentalist party. In the past, when religious fundamentalism appeared to be getting strong, the military would intervene, sometimes quite brutally, up until 1980. The fact that this coexistence has been possible, given the fact that the religious party is a fact of life, I think provides an opportunity for us. They're upset with the George W. Bush administration, not because of a growth of religious fundamentalism, but because they were categorically opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq and absolutely refused to let us use their territory at all for armored units or supplies or anything else.
We're almost out of time. Let's just quickly go around the table. Will there be another attack on the scale of 9/11 in our country in the next 5 years? Marty, yes or no?
There will be if there is any country in the world which becomes a place where the people like Osama bin Laden can operate freely.
Art?
I think there'll be other attacks. I certainly hope not. The president in his West Point speech was very explicit in saying that we have forestalled similar attacks.
And Bob?
I can't say yes or no. What I can say is that as long as we're over there in large numbers, we have to be worried about the next attack.
Beyond the Beltway is a Jenny B. production in association with Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Our thanks tonight to Tom Veracruz, Ben Stewart, Fritz Goldman, and Alex Goldman for their assistance in the production of the show. My thanks again to Robert Pape of the University of Chicago, Art Sear from Carthage College, and Marty Garrity. Thanks one and all. Bruce Dumont will be back next week. I'm John Dempsey, live in Chicago.
The best age for your child to learn to read is during the first 5 years of life. Kathleen discovered this fact firsthand.
A friend of ours recommended the Your Baby Can Read series when we had our first child, Jacob. Never thought anything of it. We plopped him down in front of it.
Your Baby Can Read worked amazingly well.
When Jacob was 3 years old, he was reading at second grade level. He turned 5 in July, went to kindergarten, and in 3 weeks he was moved to first grade.
Kathleen knows it's no coincidence.
Because we have 3 children and all are reading on a high level. School is very easy. Straight A students, maybe 1 or 2 children, but all 3, probably a successful video. So bam, it worked.
Did Kathleen have to work at it?
No, I didn't have to do a thing. Your Baby Can Read definitely gives them a life skill that can never be taken away from them. It's been invaluable.
For a limited time, you can receive a completely risk-free trial of the Your Baby Can Read program. Call now and we'll also include 3 free learning gifts with your risk-free trial. Call 1-800-508-3105. 800-508-3105. 800-508-3105.
Hey, that stack of money over there with the googly eyes, is that the money you could be saving with Geico?
It's the money I am saving with Geico. He helped me buy this pool table.
Nice. So what else does he do? Can he tell jokes?
Seriously, Kevin, he's a stack of money. He doesn't tell jokes. He just blinks and buys me stuff.
Well, I just thought...
Money can't talk. That's ridiculous. Why do you always take it too far?
Me?
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Get the good stuff!
Give the holiday gift that keeps on fixing. The 7-piece gear wrench ratcheting wrench set available at your local Napa Auto Parts store for just $29.99, a savings of 70%. These versatile combination wrenches work in tight spaces while offering the speed of a ratchet. 7-piece gear wrench ratcheting wrench sets are available in SAE or metric sizes. Now for just $29.99 at Napa.
Napa. Get the good stuff!
Shaquille O'Neal for Icy Hot.
I need pain relief that won't mess with my grip.
The new Icy Hot No Mess Applicator. Powerful, targeted, long-lasting pain relief now in a roll-on applicator. No mess. Just maximum strength medicine for back, shoulders, knees, even arthritis. Massages in icy to dull the pain, hot to relax it away.
Wherever I hurt, wherever I go.
Stop pain right at the source with the new Icy Hot No Mess Applicator.
No pain, no mess.
For temporary topical pain relief, use only as directed.
Announcing the Ally Bank online savings account with the rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at allybank.com or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward. Member FDIC.